Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Tim Phillips is a freelance journalist who's written for The Wall Street Journal Europe, The International Herald Tribune, The Guardian, The Observer, The Daily Telegraph, The Independent, and The Daily Express, among others. He's a frequent guest on BBC Television and Radio and Sky News, as well as a regular conference speaker. He's author of many professional books, including Fit to Bust, How Great Companies Fail, Knock Off, The Deadly Trade in Counterfeit Goods, and he's co-author of the best-selling Scoring Points. He's also author of a new book, Talk Normal. Tim, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, our inability to talk normal, according to your book, has reached epidemic proportions. How has this happened?
I think it's just through general inattention. We rather consider that talking normal is the sort of thing that we can all do because we've all been talking for a very long time by the time that we get to work. We assume that just because we do so much of it, we all do it rather well, and that people who are at the top of their profession do it better than the people around them. And I don't think that's the case. Because of the pressures of work and because of the need to communicate so much at work, our mistakes have been institutionalized. Mm-hmm. In some ways, we're getting worse, not better.
Tim, I'm just curious, is America to blame for this?
No, there are wonderful improvements in the language that the United States has been responsible for. What isn't good is the general coining of new words where there are lots of really adequate words for what we're saying already. We just have to create a new one that few people can understand. One of the reasons this is a negative trend is this. Most of the people who speak English in the world don't speak it as a first language. Very often, their problem is there are so many words for everything you want to say, we can't keep track of it all. You could say that's a problem for them, but it's also a problem for us. If we're doing business with them, if they're working for us, if they're working alongside us, this constant having to change and move the language around for no good effect isn't always a good thing.
All right. What are the three guiding principles of talk normalism?
The first one is try and be understood by everybody you're speaking to. We don't always check that.
Right.
One of the things about jargon is we get a lot of pleasure out of it because it puts us in the in-group, the people who understand the jargon. But unfortunately, if we have a responsibility for the people in the out-group as well. Second one is stop trying to sound clever because sounding clever doesn't get you anywhere. Anyone can explain a difficult thing so that it sounds like it's difficult. It takes insight to take something that's complex and make it sound simple for people to create understanding. That's what we should be doing with language. And the third one is, it's about attitude, not about rules. Everybody makes grammar mistakes, jargon mistakes.
Yep.
If we get hung up on the rules, we'll lose sight of what we're here to do, which is to communicate with each other and be understood.
In the chapter related to office life, you not only describe but diagram the donut of excitement. Can you explain this concept to us?
This was a way to explain that the most obvious response to a question is sometimes not the way to go. If you imagine this donut, the closer your answer to a question came to the center, the more obvious and the less interesting it was, like it's important to add value, world peace is a good thing kind of answers. And the further away from the center, the more interesting and unusual it is. The idea is to take yourself away from those middle-of-the-donut answers and get to the edge of the donut. Outside the donut, you're getting a little bit extreme. There's reasons not to do that, like, for example, politeness and courtesy. And the way you get to the edge of that donut is to, first of all, be specific. Use numbers to measure things, not words like, well, it's a significant opportunity. And the second thing is use real life. Describe to people what things are like, what they would see in front of them. The difference things will make to the way they live or they work. The middle of the donut is a very safe zone.
Sure.
That's not really where we should be.
Now, also of note is a subchapter, How HR Ruined Your Life, where you throw a little mud on some current HR favorite terms, such as passionate, onboarding, and role player.
Yes. What annoys me about them is we've come to this formalism about the sort of language that we use when we are talking about our jobs, which have been renamed roles.
Right.
A lot of us have roles. We're acting rather than doing. So we've created this language, I think, almost to entertain ourselves. It sometimes makes our jobs seem rather better than they are. And I suppose we like to do that sometimes when work is boring.
Right. Do you have any examples?
Passion, mm-hmm. What I call passion on demand, is something that has always irritated me. Someone who's the boss of his company mm-hmm. said to me, why does everyone, when they come in for interviews with me now, claim that they're always passionate about the job? He says, I run the company and I'm not passionate about it. I'm very interested, I'm very motivated, mm-hmm. not passionate about it. I'm passionate about my wife and my kids and my hobbies. I looked up what people claim to be passionate about. People claim to be passionate about anything, and what that does is just devalues passion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It becomes a meaningless word. HR is based on competition. We're competing for jobs. We're competing for attention. Sometimes that competition gets into the language and the language loses its meaning. The problem is HR is about people, their feelings and their needs. And for that, using language responsibly is very, very important.
Okay, now there's another issue, and that's PowerPoint. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The problem with PowerPoint is it manages to capture all the small problems about how we communicate at work and amplify them. It puts them up on a big screen in front of us. For example, very often people are giving the presentation. It's not their presentation.
Hmm.
They're popping up the things on the screen, and those words that are on the screen, they're not there for the audience anymore. They're there for the person who's presenting.
Right.
Sort of cues. Oh, this is what I have to talk about now. We've lost the ability to tell a story.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
We love to talk about solutions. And the reason we talk about solutions is we've not described the problem. So we talk about something as being, I don't know, a logistics solution. Well, we're not saying exactly what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
There's this fundamental lack of understanding going on. You can come out of something like that and you can think, I've spent 45 minutes listening to this guy, but if he didn't exist, I don't know why we'd need to invent him. So the structure of PowerPoint has rather taken over from the process of communicating, which is a shame. It could be great. It's just not turned out that way.
There are other people who have very strong feelings about it, most notably information designer and specialist Edward Tufte. He goes so far as to almost indict PowerPoint for the death of the Challenger astronauts because they had all the data to indicate that it was a bad idea to launch on a cold day. It was just that they were spread out over three different slides.
This is serious business. Work is what we do all day. It's how we live our lives. And if we're not doing it optimally because of things that can easily be cured, and if it becomes dangerous because of that, it's literally a waste of our lives. I spoke to a Swiss guy recently who's launched the anti-PowerPoint party. And because of Swiss electoral law, as long as he gets a certain number of people signed up to support him, he can then stand in elections. So it could be possible that we have our first anti-PowerPoint members of parliament. I'd hesitate to say there's a movement forming behind this, but it's just a shame to me that we've all become very passive about so many of these things, about our communication at work. Everybody comes out and says, oh, look, some more PowerPoint. What are we going to do about that? Well, we go straight back to the office and we produce our own 50 slide decks and we give it back to people. That seems to be a negative spiral to me.
Tim, do you have any thoughts on social media tools such as Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn?
Now, this is not all good. There was a time in the past when communication was only done by a few people at work, and now we're all communicating all the time. That can be great.
Right.
It's good that people can be open about their lives and things that need to be communicated. What it means, though, is that very often we don't structure our thoughts before we try and communicate them. We're so busy communicating, we don't bother to think, what do people need to hear? What do they really not need to hear now? What's our priority to get things done? So it gets in the way sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm sure we've all had days where you spend so much time communicating with people about what needs to be done. You get to the end of the working day and you haven't actually started doing it yet. The other thing social media does is tend to amplify things.
Mm-hmm.
We were brought up as the first generation of bloggers to believe that if we had opinions, our opinions could be modified by comments, and we'd reach this golden mean, this consensus about things.
Right.
It doesn't tend to happen like that. The way the groups work in practice is that very often we're attracted to people who we already agree with.
Right.
Then we comment, and then the group becomes more and more extreme. And it's not exclusively social media's fault. This is a process that's been going on ever since people have been communicating. But social media is also the great example of how we sometimes don't reach consensus, we don't reach agreement, we just start arguing.
Exactly. Do you have any concluding thoughts before we wrap up here, Tim?
Yes. If we just communicated a little bit less, what we would get out, the result of that communication, could be so much better. Prioritizing isn't just ordering your thoughts. It's what you leave out. It's saying, not now, let's do that later. If there was a little bit more of that, then we'd have more 10-slide PowerPoint presentations that you could get through in 15 minutes. You would have more short meetings, and you'd have emails that say everything in one paragraph rather than in 15 paragraphs. I think the world would be a better place for that.
We've been speaking to Tim Phillips, author of the book Talk Normal, Stop the Business Speak, Jargon, and Waffle, published by Kogan Page. Tim, thank you so much for being with us on Edgewise today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Are you responsible for creating online content that connects with customers? AMA's new hands-on writing program offers skills, tools, and professional instructor feedback to help you improve your online content and bottom line results. For more information, visit amanet.org and type 2182 into the search box. We'd love to get your feedback on today's program. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.